Good morning.
Good morning.
First case of the morning will be Joel Hortness versus Neenah Joint School District. Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Your Honors. I know you've read the cases and you've read the briefs. There are a few facts, though, that I think are worthy of reiterating. And I'll specifically refer to the hearing officer's decision that made the findings of fact and the conclusions of law. One, everyone concedes, and I think it is important, that this student did receive appropriate services and receive an appropriate education at the SSOS, Sonia Shankman. And in finding number 50 of the decision of the hearing officer, he said the student has received appropriate educational services at SSOS since his enrollment. And as it relates to reimbursement, the cost of tuition, room, and board at SSOS is regulated by the state of Illinois and is within the range of reasonableness. I bring that up because I think that this case, in large part, was decided because of the great cost that was associated with the private placement. However, it was a placement that was needed for this child for a very short period of time. He's now been reintegrated into the public school setting, but without this kind of intervention, it would not have been possible. Now, what do we know about the process as it went through the lower court? Well, the lower court took the position that the IEP that had been developed could be implemented by the school. Well, we agree. It was the same IEP that the school had provided 2 years prior and before the child went to the private placement. Now, if this logic is permitted to continue, it would mean that next year the same goals and objectives could be written, the expectations could be lowered still further, and it would still be an appropriate program. And the year after that, the same goals and objectives could be written, and the expectations could be lowered, and it would still be appropriate after that.
The expectations could be lowered. What do you mean?
Well, in the goals and objectives, 2 years ago, before he went to the placement, the goals and objectives had as their criteria for mastery 70%, 80%, 60%, some value given to it that would show here's where we're trying to reach at the end of a school year. And actually, as the hearing officer noted, and these are factual findings, the only thing that changed in the IEP that the school wrote before private placement was that where in the previous IEP at school he had been expected to achieve at a 60% level, now he was expected to achieve at a 50% level. So when you look at successive goals, they're identical. The only thing that changed from the district, from the previous IEP that it had written, was now the expectations for achievement had been lowered.
Mr. Walker, is it your bottom line that once the IEP with its goals and short-term objectives were drafted, the district should have convened a second IEP meeting so that Mr. and Mrs. Hortness could have responded to those goals and objectives?
I don't think that's part of our argument, yes, but it's not the only essence to our argument. We think that the goals and objectives that were written, if you look at them, they basically took into account nothing that had occurred in the intervening year, where everyone agrees this child made great progress at SSOS. So the goals and objectives, not only were they written without the parents, which I think is critical, but more importantly, I think, the placement decision, where this child was to go to school, was made before the goals and objectives were actually written. And placement decisions can only be made after the IEP team decides, and the parents are an equal partner in that process, what are the goals and objectives that are attainable by this child. And then after the goals and objectives are attainable, are determined, the team needs to decide what are the services that we need for this child so we can attain these services, like related services. It could be psychotherapy. It could be for a hearing-impaired child. It might be speech and language. For a child that's mentally retarded, it might be some tutoring. But until you determine those kinds of services for a child, you can't make a placement decision. Because, I'm sorry.
No, you finish your thought.
Because the bottom line is, the placement is driven by the types of services in the program you're crafting. So to make a placement decision first, and then craft a decision and craft a program that fits the placement, it's the cart before the horse. And it's inherently wrong, and it puts, if that procedure is to be followed, it inevitably means parent input in any of this process is meaningless, because a district can predetermine, as it did here, that we're going to find a program and do it in this school. Now let's craft an IEP, which our staff is capable of crafting.
It seems that if, you know, just looking at it, trying to back up and say, well, wait a minute, what did each side want? It seems that parents determined that Sonia, or whatever you want to call it, is about the best you can get. That seems to be a very outstanding place to go. The school district looked at it from the standpoint of, we can meet these requirements, as we are obligated to do, and we can put together what we think is a proper IEP, and I guess I'm not familiar with all these terms, but the FAPE and all that. So they did put that together. It seems that you used the word, I think, predetermined. It seems that each side is maybe predetermined of what they want to do, and it doesn't matter what the other side offers.
Well, I have to respectfully disagree with that to some extent. The parents had tried a less restrictive placement in prior years, and the evidence will show it. I'm not going to go into it. That didn't fulfill this child's needs. It was a local school. It wasn't a public school. So they had tried something that was less...
A local private school?
Yes. They had tried something that was less intrusive. It just didn't work. They also tried the school program. It's not like this was their first choice. This was the last choice. A lot of parents, these included, don't take on this kind of financial responsibility and burden unless they're forced to, just like I think most parents don't run to get a lawyer and file due process. It's the last choice that they have, not the first. So there were a lot of things that happened before. So I don't believe that the parents went into this predetermined. They went into this and said, if it were their choice, can the school provide the kinds of services that Sonia Shankman did? And they brought in the people that could give them the information to do that. The school, if you look at the IEP, didn't include anything from the Sonia Shankman people, because the IEP is the same. So when they say, well, we went to the school for a half a day and we talked to the teachers and we made observations, the bottom line is none of that information ended up being part of the IEP that they created.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned is that no one from the Sonia Shankman school was included in the April 22nd IEP meeting. But didn't the district make allowance for participation either in person or by telephone? In other words, why would the fault lie with the district on this point?
It's a good question, and I don't know that it's a fair answer, but the reality is it wouldn't fall on the district if they had staff that was sufficiently skilled that could fill the voids. Because they didn't have staff that were sufficiently skilled.
That sure doesn't answer the question.
Well, I'm sorry, I'll be more direct.
The question was, why is the district at fault for them not participating? They had every opportunity to participate.
Well, the school could have invited them. The school could have paid a few dollars and had them participate. The school could have generated a telephone conference call. The school did none of those. Those are simple things to do. It's easy to say, well, why didn't the parents bring them, or why didn't the parents do this, and why didn't the parents do that? And I agree, you can say all those things. But the reality of it is the school is charged with the responsibility of creating an appropriate program, and they needed these people to participate.
They Forget created about what they thought was a reasonable program.
Well, that's what they testified to.
Yeah.
I don't know that they believed it. It was a program that they had done
a year
and a half.
You think they're liars?
Well, the evidence does show that the testimony was inaccurate at best. Mm. They testified, I'm sorry to be so blunt, but the testimony at the trial, the testimony at the trial showed that the IEP meeting was recorded. Everyone knew it was recorded. And the testimony the district elicited during the hearing just wasn't true. They said these goals and objectives were discussed at the IEP meeting, and the tape shows that they were not. So you know, I don't know that this case has to be resolved on that, but those are the facts. They testified about things that just weren't true. You know, the district cites in its brief the evidence that these people offered at trial, and they did offer the evidence at trial that the district says that they offered. However, the tape shows that that evidence was not true, was not truthful. That tape was part of the record. And if you look at the hearing officer's decision, he makes note of the fact that representations the district said about things that occurred at the IP just weren't true. So, yes, the district... I'm sorry.
Well, I don't want to interrupt, but I want to just stay focused a little bit about the result. When you... What do you call it? Instead of 60% achievement, do you call it?
Yes.
Instead, they lowered it to 50%?
That was just an example, yes.
Well, I don't know what the facts are, but what I understand is this person, this young man, Joel, has an exceptional IQ. This guy is real smart. He also has this disability challenging that. Is the B-plus to A grade level that he achieved at some point, is that based on some 60% achievement, or is that what he got?
No. It's really broken down into two aspects. There are goals and objectives that are determined to be met or mastered in an IEP and in special education. And then there are subjects that a child like Joel, who could participate in, can do, which are not goals and objectives. Let's say the most common example for lay people or people that aren't familiar with special education or do this on a regular basis is you have people who are autistic, and they can multiply numbers in their head that none of us could even hope to do.
Math, you might have excelled.
Right. So, but those aren't goals and objectives. This was a child whose behaviors were interfering with his ability to actually, you know, if you want to sit in and watch these oral arguments, to be able to do that, just to sit in, not to talk, for him to interact with his peers, for him to participate as an adult or a young adult in society. These were behaviors that had to be addressed in order for him to develop the social cues that he needed to understand pragmatic language and things of that nature.
Okay, and now he is at a high school level and in what, mainstreamed or whatever you want to call it?
Yes, he's mainstreamed not in this public school, but in a public school setting that provides the kind of services the parents think he's now ready for. So it had never been their desire to send him to Chicago. It's just that there was no alternative that could address the kinds of significant difficulties that his disability presented.
So at this juncture, we're talking about reimbursement for the cost of the education?
Yes.
Now you're into your rebuttal time if you want to reserve.
Thanks very much.
Ms. Lubinsky?
Yes, thank you. My name is Lori Lubinsky. I represent the Neenah Joint School District. This case is not about the cost of the education. It's about the facts as applied to the law. The law in this circuit was announced in Heather S. v. State of Wisconsin, 125 Fed 3rd 1045. In that case, the court talked about what does the IDEA require, and what are those requirements in the context of a case like this where you have a parentally placed or unilateral placement by the parents in a private school.
Well, now, Ms. Lubinsky, if we accept the ALJ's finding that goals and short-term objectives were not meaningfully discussed at that April 22nd IEP meeting, then why wasn't the district obligated to convene a second IEP meeting once its staff had drafted the goals and short-term objectives?
If you accept the conclusion, and I think the conclusion of the ALJ was that they weren't explicitly discussed, the district court in this case made clear that while they were not discussed word for word, the testimony was clear and the tapes are clear. And I listened.
Well, now, speaking of that,
yes.
Forgive me, but Mr. Walker suggests that the testimony of both Ms. Lang and Ms. Dyer regarding what occurred at that April 22nd meeting was, shall we say, false in certain key respects. So I would like you to address that point and how credibility may have factored into the ALJ's finding that goals and short-term objectives were not truly addressed at the April 22nd meeting. I mean, the fact of the matter is we owe deference to the ALJ.
You do owe deference to factual findings of the ALJ,
right.
Yes, clearly under the law. The ALJ never found a credibility finding. I need to make that clear. The ALJ never found that these witnesses were lying in their testimony. In fact, their testimony supports the conclusion that these concepts, the idea of hand-raising, the idea of looking at cue cards, the idea of using videotape, those are on the tape. Those were discussed.
But surely you're not saying, I mean, the way I read it, the ALJ's characterization of that April 22nd meeting was that the discussion of the goals and objectives was absolutely not adequate.
That was his conclusion, yes. That was a conclusion based on two premises that are faulty. Number one, he concluded that it was inadequate because the school district in his mind would not consider the parent's placement at a private institution. And the law on that issue is abundantly clear. We cited, I believe, two or three district court cases and a First Circuit case in our brief. And the district court in this case relied upon those very cases that say a school district that finds, it's the concept of least restrictive environment. It's very common sense. Under IDEA, a school has an obligation to place a student in the least restrictive environment, mainstreaming. If the school, the team, determines that a public placement is the least restrictive, it necessarily follows that the school need not consider a private placement, even one that the parents request. There are no less than four cases cited in our brief for that proposition.
See, as far as you're going, okay. But here's the problem, the way I view it. We owe enormous deference to the ALJ. If we accept the ALJ's findings that the overall goals and short-term objectives were not discussed on April 22nd, and his finding that the district came into that meeting with its mind already made up to place Joel in one of the district's own schools, and the district never genuinely considered a private placement, then it would seem that the ALJ correctly concluded that the parents were not given a meaningful opportunity to participate, and that therefore, Joel was denied a free, appropriate public education. So, I mean, I think that's what we have to zero in on, were, you know, whether or not the parents were given this meaningful opportunity.
And respectfully, they were. They were given opportunity by being a part of no less than three IEP meetings, two of which they had an advocate with. They were given meaningful opportunity by being involved in a 2.5-hour IEP meeting where, if somebody listens to these tapes, it will be abundantly clear. In due respect, Mr. Hortness was not at the meeting. For whatever reason, it's not in the record. He chose not to be there. Mrs. Hortness had one thing and only one thing on her mind: placement at Sonia Shankman. She was the one at the meeting that said, the issue on the table today is whether you're going to pay for Sonia Shankman. She was the one that wanted to jump ahead and not even discuss goals and objectives and go right to placement. So to look, if this court decides to adopt the Ninth Circuit opinion that a procedural violation that seriously infringes a parent's right to participate, if you choose to adopt that, and it's not the law of this circuit yet, if you choose to adopt that language, then you need to determine whether those factual findings that you're going to give due deference to, whether that's a serious infringement in light of the facts of this case. What do we know about that? We know, we talked about the meetings. We talked about the advocate. We talked about the fact that, with all due respect, the Sonia Shankman data that's been discussed at oral argument and was discussed in the briefs was not even available until 6 to 8 months later.
Well, this was just 2 months into that period, wasn't it?
Yes, he was. He was parentally placed at Sonia Shankman in January of 04. They went to Sonia Shankman in March of 04. At that time, Sonia Shankman had not developed a goal, had not developed an objective, was basically watching this kid. They had planned ignoring of behavioral problems, and they had their rules posted. They were gathering their data. And so to suggest that we didn't use Sonia Shankman data is to suggest that we didn't use something that didn't exist. What we do know is that these parents were given every opportunity possible. To suggest that the words, "Joel will demonstrate appropriate hand-raising procedures 5 out of 10 times in class," and to suggest that because those words or were not said directly or written down on a piece of paper is a serious infringement of a right to participate.
There's a couple things. And I asked earlier the other side on this predetermination. Now, you've emphasized that the ordinances were predetermined to get to, and I can understand their motive. This Sonia Shankman is apparently a very top grade. This may be the best place. They also apparently sent them to other private places, didn't work out as well. They seem to be saying that you are, at least as predetermined, not you, meaning the school district, to make sure that they get whatever, you're going to accommodate them, whether it be for costs or just because of experience or meeting the law, et cetera. So I guess I just wanted, this isn't a predetermination, I guess you would say, on your part, on the school's part?
It's not, and it's not for two reasons. The ALJ, and you talked about Judge Due Deference, and due deference is certainly appropriate for factual findings, but this ALJ found that there was a predetermination, and he in his decision said explicitly it was entirely circumstantial, and he based it on two conclusions. Number one, the conclusion that the school district didn't seriously consider the parents' request. The law on that is clear. There is no law to the contrary. They need not. And the district court properly said the law doesn't require them to consider a private placement when they first decide that a less restrictive placement is appropriate. Okay? So there were, again, two factual underpinnings to his conclusion that there was a predetermination, one of which falls.
Is a private placement determined restrictive? Is that...
A private placement is inherently more restrictive than a public school placement. I hope that answers your question. I also want to address... I have 1 minute remaining, sorry.
No,
I want to address...
5 minutes remaining.
Oh, thank you. I want to address briefly the contention that the reason why the Hortnesses were at Sonia Shankman was because the school district... prior placements didn't work, and that, you know, this IEP was simply a redo of the old IEP. With all due respect, that's not the evidence. The evidence is that these parents unilaterally withdrew their son. They filed a due process hearing request, the one prior to why we're here today. They took that, they lost. They appealed that to the federal district court in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and that case was dismissed. There is a finding that the prior IEP that seems to be so problematic here today did provide Joel with a free and appropriate public education. So we start with that position, and then we look at a unilateral placement that apparently there's no dispute here didn't work. So they put Joel in a different private placement, and that is at Sonia Shankman. Meanwhile, the school's not educating Joel because of the parents' request, not because of anything they did. And I want that to be clear.
They meaning the school.
They meaning the school. We have a decision from an administrative law judge that is a final decision saying that prior IEP provided them with provided Joel with a free and appropriate public education. And so the suggestion that because... And I do dispute adamantly the conclusion that these two IEPs are identical. Not true. The IEPs are not identical. The goals and objectives have some common terminology. They talk this student's disability didn't change. He is autistic. He has medical diagnoses, including but not limited to OCD. He needed social skills instruction. Social skills instruction is not a word you're going to see in that prior IEP. Direct 60 minutes a day instruction of Joel in things like turn-taking, raising your hand, things of that nature, not in the prior IEP.
The prior meaning the one before the one at issue.
Correct. And I raise these things because apparently the contention is that, you know, these goals and objectives were predetermined because it's identical to the prior IEP. Not even the ALJ found that. The ALJ's conclusion was that there was common terminology used in some of the goals and objectives. We've got a prior conclusion that that prior IEP provided FAPE. There's absolutely nothing wrong with a year later talking about similar goals and objectives. Opposing counsel talks about the percentages and how they changed. The reality is that this school took three representatives down to Chicago from Nina. They interviewed staff. They observed Joel. They gave the Hortnesses forms to fill out, getting information from them. They offered no less than four separate times to meet. They actually met on three different occasions, but at the final meeting, they offered four times. They said, if you want to bring Sonia Shankman down, or up, excuse me, feel free to do that. We'll arrange a telephone conference. We'll do all that. And what did the Hortnesses say? The Hortnesses never said, we need to cancel this meeting because we can't prepare. You don't have enough information. What they said is, hey, please reschedule, but for the reason of we want you to wait for the Sonia Shankman data. The data that came 6 to 8 months later and the data that they couldn't wait for because they were under a mandate by the Department of Public Instruction saying you shall complete that IEP by May 3rd. They couldn't wait anymore. So to suggest that the parents were not, that their rights were seriously, or they were seriously infringed, is to deny all of their participation.
This deadline that could not be met, apparently, to provide the information they needed.
Correct. In fact, the deadline was extended. The facts are that the deadline was in early March or April. The school asked for a 90-day extension. DPI said, we'll give you an extension, but we're only giving you 45 days.
It looks to me like we have nothing but a hindsight analysis here. That's a little bit frustrating. Maybe it's true that they couldn't get it from Sonia Shankman until several months after the deadline.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Did the data ultimately, what we do know is we know that they asked Sonia Shankman, are our observations today, I see my time is up.
Finish your sentence.
Are our observations today typical of Joel's behavior? Are they typical of what you've seen in the last 2 months? There was no dispute. The answer was yes. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Walker?
Thank you very much.
You've got 2 minutes.
A couple of things. If you look at Murfreesboro, the case out of this circuit, it says that mainstreaming is not to be promoted at the expense of the types of services that a child needs to develop at the core of the IEP and what this child needs. I know I'm doing disjustice to the actual wording, but it's cited in the brief. The other thing is this. When we talk about participation, we're not talking about some minor thing here. We're talking about goals and objectives. And if you read the hearing officer's decision, and he's the same hearing officer that had decided the previous case that she relied on. So I think if you're going to give him deference in one case, you need to give him deference in the other case. The parents aren't asking for a Cadillac here. The parents looked for something that would be less intrusive and couldn't find it because of this child's particular needs. And this is also not a case of hindsight. If the school could not get the data, and I think the Shapiro case versus Paradise Valley out of the Ninth Circuit is a perfect example of this. The court there held, look, the school can't blame the parents for not providing this or not providing that or not getting this. In the absence of getting that data from someone else that they hoped would arrive in a timely fashion, they had the obligation nonetheless to create the data themselves then. In other words, you need the data that drives this IEP. It would be great if it had gotten from Sonia Shankman, fine. But to say we're going to relieve the school of its burden to generate that data and an IEP that it has an obligation to do is a disjustice.
And Sonia Shankman the only one that could have provided that data since they had the student?
The school could have, if it chose to, have done some assessments of its own. It chose to rely on the data that Sonia Shankman had because it was good and accurate data. Some of that data was provided. What they're talking about that they didn't receive were there some assessments that were still ongoing. But this, as she had indicated, this child had been to that school a while. The books were open to the staff when they came to Sonia Shankman. They could look at anything they had, including their clinical reports, their notes, their observations, all the things that had been done. And she's suggesting that they weren't doing anything. The reality of it was, before you could get much accomplished for this child, you had to get a handle on the behaviors that were driving and impeding his learning. This was the first order of operation for Sonia Shankman. If it could have been done in a less restrictive environment, the parents would have been thrilled.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel.
Thank you.